This week's Symptomatic Redness is a special. It features Derek Varn and Michael Brooks talking about the Democratic Party, the left, the DSA, and how to situate yourself in this moment where socialism seems impossible. The Symptomatic Redness podcast is usually behind a paywall. It's made available every month to our Patreon supporters. If you are a regular listener to the Zero Squared podcast, you might consider becoming a supporter of ours on Patreon. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again on Wednesday or Thursday, somewhere around there.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. This is a show about politics, history, and theory. And today we're going to talk about the paradox of practical politics and liberalism with Michael Brooks. So that's a over-intellectual way to phrase it. But yeah, so I heard you mention me on, and I'm going to be a narcissist for a second, but my ears always perk up when I'm listening to someone else's show, and I have no idea I'm going to come up in a conversation. As on the Parallax Views by J.G. Michael, as like the not stupid critique of liberalism, as opposed to a certain unnamed other podcaster who I will not mention. Now, you said that there's been a trend on the left for a while, and I think it was easier to believe under Obama that liberalism, and by liberalism here, we're going to have to like slow down and be kind of technical, because when I use the term liberalism, I mean something different than the way most people use it. And I think that's a big thing that people miss. Because from my perspective, like most everything in America, including even Trump, would be liberal in some sense. And in a way that actually makes the term kind of useless to talk about.
You mean in a very historical, right, sort of free market, constitutional order sort of sense?
Yeah, I mean, like, if you compare, for example, like, and the reason why I think it's important, though, if you compare, when you talk about, say, the European New Right or some of these fringe rightist movements that have only weirdos like me ever heard about till about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Those are not liberal in any sense.
Right, right.
They're something else. But yeah, in the big broad sense, when I talk about liberalism, I'm kind of talking about like the Enlightenment political tradition as has come down to us in a variety of ways. So when most people say liberal, I actually say left liberal to clarify that. But there's been this tendency to paint those guys as like, okay, Marxists really have to fight the Democratic Party and the liberals and whatever. And in a time when Democrats seem ascendant but feckless, which has been most times since the 70s, that narrative is attractive, I think, historically. But you hinted that there's a pretty big delusion to that. And it, ironically, I actually agree with you. So I wanted to start there. What do you think is the problem with this casting of Obama and Trump aren't that different? Well, okay, there's some truth to that, but it's also kind of embarrassing.
I think you hit it with the word embarrassing. I think of it in three ways. I mean, first, I feel like there is this interesting phenomenon in general right now, and I don't mean this in terms of like highbrow or lowbrow or, you know, academic or popular or any of those types of things. Because, I mean, I'll say as an example, I think the ideal is to play in as many of different, like, I think the ideal is to, you know, have work that has rigor and credibility and serious analysis and is also, you know, broadly accessible and engaging to people. That's certainly one of my aspirations. But outside of that, it seems to me that in the culture right now, there is a real, and I don't know what drives it, and maybe it's not even novel to our time, but there's a lot of stupid versions of even potentially pretty smart arguments, if that makes sense. I mean, you know, we don't need to sort of get into him, but even like this Jordan Peterson thing we've mentioned so many times, like Jordan Peterson, I mean, okay, let's take it in the Jungian direction. Well, why isn't somebody like James Hillman taking that slot, right? Now, I'm not a Jungian, but James Hillman was a fascinating Jungian writer and analyst, and actually somebody who actually suggested a lot of the opposite things about Jordan Peterson, such as like sort of mass psychic suffering reflected actually the fact that, you know, our society was fundamentally dysfunctional. And, you know, why would you want to adjust to a maladjusted society and so on, right? Point is, like, but swimming in similar waters, but in a much more interesting and in-depth way. And I just think that, you know, as somebody who, you know, we're probably like, you know, what are you, like early 30s, late 20s, mid 30s? Like,
I'm 37.
That's the same bulb. I'm 34. So I was, you know, okay, I started sort of thinking about politics while I was a teenager and, you know, it was very kind of started getting engaged at like the tail end of like anti-globalization protests and, you know, Democracy Now and Noam Chomsky and this sort of thing. So the, you know, basic critique that the Democratic Party, if we're going to take it to such a narrow lens, has been, you know, utterly co-opted by the U.S. corporate sector is a very, very standard issue argument, right? And you could make that argument, I think, from the kind of more sort of narrow, and I don't mean like accurate enough, just more narrow, just the kind of progressive sense that, like, you know, it's the money's corrupted the whole system and, you know, Goldman and pharma lobbies and contributes to everybody. And then you could also make it in the more sort of broad sense, which is like, to me, it's just the simple paradox of, you know, fundamentally in a market economy, you know, particularly the United States, which doesn't even have like a historical labor party. The Democratic Party is a much more amorphous beast than that. You are playing on the right's playing field, essentially. You're on their terrain. So structurally, how far can, you know, parties of the center left go? And then certainly in the last 30 years, and this was reflected in like the global third way, the rules of capitalism and sort of market harmonization kind of dictated that, you know, in some ways really by necessity. I think sometimes, again, people just make this too moralistic. I think there are plenty of third way people and, you know, there's the sort of Tony Blair and Bill Clintons of that world who, you know, we could, I mean, certainly a Blair, you know, just sort of essentially right wing kind of slightly socially moderate politics, scooping up corporate money and very comfortable with oligarchs. And then I think there's an example of somebody like a Lula in Brazil who might fit that model, who's eminently more defensible. And actually did in his historical moment figure out a way to do some real redistribution, even though, as evidenced by his own current persecution, did not do real structural reforms in Brazil, which might not have even been possible, if we're being honest, at the time that he was governing, right? So there's this background, I think, of a certain kind of literacy that allows you to, yes, understand and have a critique of the, you know, either just narrow partisan assessments of politics or even more specifically of our time, the specific focus of Donald Trump is just the unique novel site of all corruption, evil, dysfunction of the world. Okay. And that's an important analysis, but it's turned into, and that's how I read, you know, the sort of stronger version of that argument. And I'm sure you'll elaborate it. But I think that there is a mode that actually, ironically, has usually come from not some of the more really radical and foundational and structural critiques of how politics got shrunk in even the last 30 or 40 years, or how do you have left-oriented politics in a market society, you know, these types of real contradictions and challenges, but really just into sort of like, you know, a very simple just kind of campaign contributions and morality narrative. And it almost has turned politics, it's become a neurotic, obsessive minding and also an act of a lot of false equivalence. So it's one thing to say Obama did some very disgusting things on immigration as well. There's no doubt about it. And he certainly did not reform ICE by any stretch of the imagination. He was a participant in these policies. But he also created DACA, and also the purpose behind even his obscene policies was his, you know, typical kind of technocratic centrist play of like, you know, I'm going to own their turf by being tough, and then I'm going to open the space to make a deal. Now, this is not my politics, and I have, you know, strategic and moral critiques of that like everybody else. But if you can't recognize that that is fundamentally different than, you know, an accelerated war, in fact, on all kinds of immigration, and even like a new status on the new posture towards people specifically coming in trying to seek refuge, not even quote unquote crossing the border illegally, you're drawing a false equivalency. And then you're also getting into a zone where you just have your head up your ass. And I think it is embarrassing in the sense that if we were to be charitable to quote unquote, like maybe just sort of more normal liberal people for a second, which I actually think sometimes people should be, there might be the excess of, you know, we just want Obama back and there was no problem ever and Trump's the worst thing ever and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Right. So we need to correct that if we want to really do some more structural things in politics. But they actually are at times, if they're talking about the specifics of a policy, they're actually going to have a much better grasp of some of the intricacies of these things than somebody who's just committed to telling that same story again and again and again and again. And the only thing I just buttoned on it is it really does start to strike me, and I see with certain media personalities, it's like if your only posture and reflex to a present horror is to refer to a previous horror, that starts to strike me as just a media brand differentiating game and not one of engaging with the actual historical moment. So it's like, yes, I would say fuck neoliberalism, and I'm a little bit tongue in cheek here, but you know, spare a thought for galloping fascism. That's actually happening now. Barack Obama, like the only, it's like there is this type of like kind of dumb left position I call. It's like, it's only them and Alex Jones and Donald Trump that all seem to think that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are still running the country. They're not. There is another grouping in power. And yes, the contrary problem is this hashtag resistance hysteria, and there's nothing structural, and they just want Trump to leave, and then there'll be no problems. Of course that's a problem. But not having any ability to deal with what is now, not through saying let's understand history, but let's just reduce everything to false equivalencies to score sort of moral points in some imagined internal game. I just think it's performative, it's reductive, it's delusional, and embarrassing.
Thinking about that for a second, and I'll ask you a question. I have found it interesting. I listen to Vox and all these wonky podcasts, and the reason why I listen to them, it's the same reason why I read The Economist and Financial Times, right? They're closer to power and they're more honest.
Right.
So, for example, I know from reading that and reading some policy papers about Obama's weird history with ICE, and everyone can cite the early Obama years where they were more efficient at deporting than any time that Trump has been so far. But what people miss, and I think some of it's your branding, I think some of it's just ignorance.
Yes.
Is that those policies actually were from a very specific period in time. They were trying, because Obama was immediately getting pushback from ICE, you know, like,
yep,
from day one.
Yep.
And he was making concessions to them, which oddly enabled them to do more deportations than they could under Bush. Although, again, they didn't exist for all of the Bush years either. It's something people don't know.
That's another pretty important thing to note there with this more deportations than ever statistic. And also in the last couple of months, Trump has really been evening out, you know, that record. And also, you know, look, DACA or not DACA is an important policy distinction. You know, refugees getting, you know, children getting separated from their parents, like these are actual policy distinctions. But I like what you said about getting into that Vox Pod Save America world, because the last thing I'll interject, maybe I'm wondering if this, you'll agree with this too, is it's very clarifying to listen to that stuff, because it simultaneously really affirms, I think, on a more sort of macro and analytic level, that these people are completely unequipped to solve the problems that we face. But conversely, it's so much higher quality than so much so-called progressive, like, fantasizing and complaining, because these people actually understand the process.
Yeah.
And there's value to that.
Yeah, there's this thing where, you know, the elites aren't that elite, but at least they know what the facts are. And that was
exactly
And this is one of the things that is maddening to me. You know, I have a very highfalutin, very abstract, Adornian, you know, high Marxist critique of all this. But you also have to deal with day-to-day facts on the ground and policy implications. And one of the things that used to make me, like, infuriated, for example, you know, I can talk about how the minimum wage is never going to structurally fix the problems of poverty. And it's not. But when I would talk to, like, these Marxist groups years ago about, like, the fight for 15, it was either naively totally endorsing it, or it was people like, no, we should oppose minimum wage because that'll just weaken the working class's will for revolution.
Right.
And I was just blinking. And the two reasons I was blinking is, you know, there's the famous quote about I am not a Marxist, you know, right from Marx.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that was about was the French Marxist Party at the time actually was trying to make that argument, like, we're gonna push for all these reforms that can't happen so that when they fail, the workers will, like, rise up in revolution because they'll be immiserated. And Marx was like, that's stupid, people are gonna starve.
Yep. No, that's it. I mean, Marx was not an accelerationist. I mean, Marx also thought the outcome of the Civil War was important and got some pushback from, you know, how can you pick two sides of an imperial war, man? And what's funny to me is, you know, at least when you're kind of getting into at least some of the crazy Marxist abstractions, at least there's a little bit of Marx in it. But some of the stuff in the more popular kind of political, it isn't. One of the reasons I had such a problem with how people defended voting for Jill Stein, and I just want to stipulate that, like, my actual position on that is not particularly, I think it's like the sort of obvious position. Like, I'm not an accelerationist, so I do think that, like, Hillary Clinton is definitely preferable to Donald Trump in terms of who's, you know, who you're fighting against. And, you know, for 40 states or 38 states in the country, you can vote for whoever the hell you want to vote for. I ended up not being able to vote for Jill Stein because I honestly just found her so stupid. I couldn't do it. But it was the argument. It wasn't even like this, you know, I definitely had, yes, like I've you know, those conversations. It's like, oh no, I'm a Maoist. I'm a Trotskyite. So it's like, okay, well, cool. Right. Like, what is, okay. You know, sure.
What,
like,
does that, like, mean now? I mean,
yeah, right. Exactly. Like, okay, fair enough. But you know, maybe at least there's some theory to those conversations. That the Jill Stein thing, and as reflected through even this sort of not even Marxist kind of reflexive anti-left liberalism or anti-centrist liberalism, whatever you want to call it, it always amounted to, like, you can't ask me not to vote my conscience. And then it was like this very weird, like, wait a second, you're actually, for all of this sort of, you know, supposed radicalism. And again, what's funny is that it's not, I mean, these are the policies that I support. I think they're great, but, you know, this is not, I mean, you're basically just talking about kind of moderate social democratic stuff, which is, you know, it's lovely. It's great. I think that is definitely historically where we're at right now in terms of what to push for in an electoral plane. But, like, don't confuse yourself with how supposedly radical you think you are because you want to, you know, basically complete the New Deal. But then the other part of it was actually this voting and political engagement is my personal lifestyle brand. And it's about how I feel about myself and what I personally am comfortable with, which is, you know, I mean, look, it's precisely the opposite of sort of grounded material solidarity with other people. And that is another thing that really has caught and, you know, profoundly irritated me about those currents that I've seen.
Yeah, well, I think this is one of these weird things where the Marxists, the Jill Steinians, and the quote-unquote ID poll people actually weirdly overlap, is that they're all sort of wreckers.
Yep.
I mean, I've been talking about it for a long time. I am not an anti-electoralist either, which is something people are surprised about. I used to be. I used to be hardcore, but I just realized that even if you say, and I do think, voting in a bourgeois construct only matters on the margins. The margins matter,
right?
So
that's you just distilled it.
You know, even if it's all, it's like there is a difference between eating horse shit and eating horse shit with cyanide.
Yep.
They both suck, but one does, you know, one does not kill you nearly as fast as the other. So,
And this is actually where, you know, I also think this is where some of the relative privilege arguments, you know, do actually start. I mean, I will say, and this is, you know, this is a class background thing. My family was impacted. I mean, my family growing up, and it's a whole other sort of crazy sort of counterculture story and everything else. But for purposes of this conversation, probably never made more than $18,000 a year with a family of four. So like we were legitimately poor, right? Not like in a monetary sense. Now that meant that even honestly, frankly, what I would acknowledge are obscure things that are not, you know, they aren't structural, okay? But they literally are the difference between whether or not my family had housing, whether or not the heat stayed on at times, whether or not we were food secure at times, did take place in the margins of these government, you know, like, is that going to be a 5% increase or a 10% cut? And I got to say, people who never have had a whiff of that in their lives, and I would consider, you know, the experience I had to be very stressful and unpleasant, but, you know, nothing compared to infinitely more deprived situations. I find it morally offensive and just, you know, disgusting and performative.
Well, here's the thing. I've been torn on this for years, but one of the things I started thinking about is this sort of, I'm not going to use the dialectics word because it's overused and used wrongly so much that people don't know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to say multiple systems analysis for the analytical people and make them feel a little better. But there's sort of multi-system analysis of it, because one thing I have thought about the left, and I've thought about this for a long time, left doesn't seem to understand is both dealing in a political institution, but also knowing how to deal with like parapolitical, quasi-political, or proto-political politics, which I know that's contradictory, but like sometimes like, okay, so we know that we need to support X reform. We also know that ultimately, yes, it's not going to work.
Right.
But for a generation, there might be a generation of people who eat versus not eat because of, you know, said reform.
Exactly.
Which means opposing that electorally seems to me stupid. But we do also have to come up with sort of institutional ways without becoming NGOs. Now, I don't have a good answer for this. I really don't. But it's something I think about a lot, to deal with this without the state. Because that's actually what Marx kind of suggested. If you read the Critique of the Goethe Program, for example, that's what Marx is actually suggesting. Like, you have to seize the state eventually, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But you also have to come up with these institutions that run concurrent to it.
Right.
And the only thing the left seems to understand how to do that in is media.
That is really true. That's like, you know, I don't know if this is possible, but one of the things that also emerged in this conversation with Mark Potenga for TMBS was like, I mean, it's, you know, it's very different just because of the money and the incentive structure, but it's sort of like, in some ways, like you gotta look at like the corporate sector and sort of transnational oligarchy for examples of this. Like, even these things that we rightfully mock, like Davos, like, no, that's actually, you know, and I know there are things like the World Social Forum and stuff, but it's like somehow some fusion of like exercising raw political muscle, which has just not been here on the left for quite some time. Like, I think we're slowly rebuilding it a little bit, right? To, you know, establishing cross boundary meetings and I guess media probably is part of that. I think the media is like creating an intellectual infrastructure and a pressure. And I guess I don't know the answer to it either, but it does seem to me that the right does a very good job at that. And cop-out answer, or I don't want to say a cop-out, but it might even just be 80-90% because the playing field is totally designed in their favor, and because, you know, you can write checks and set up lobbying groups and think tanks and consultancies, and the road is paved for that really easily. And that's all true. But
it's not true for the far right, though, and they still do it better than
that. That's exactly right. And I would still even suggest for the center right or the corporate right, it still doesn't mean there isn't 10% of it that we could learn. And I have to say, part of the 10% of it that we could probably learn is probably some more senses of like cohesion and, you know, actually working in a little bit more of a systemic manner to like achieve things.
Well, it's harder to fight over. One of the reasons why the left is a circular firing squad, and, you know, I've always joked, one of my problems with the circular firing squad is also leftists don't know how to aim. Right. So it's not just a circular firing squad, it's a circular firing squad where all you're ever doing is nicking each other. It's, we have to really look at, I was thinking about, for example, if you've ever been in, you know, the DSA hasn't had a scandal about this, and let's pray that it never does, but every other left group could make scandals and Me Too movement stuff blush, if you know the history of most.
Right. And some really genuinely bad, ugly stuff.
Yeah. Some super ugly. And yeah. Part of that is the marginal nature of these groups, their structure. I mean, this is not a defense of it, it's not defensible, but it's structurally marginal people who don't have a lot of self-control, and they've invested a lot of time in things that there's not a whole lot of other incentives to invest in, and you have cult dynamics make a lot of sense.
Like, yes, that. It's cult environments, right?
And it's not intentional. I don't think these people set out to start personality cults most of the time or whatever, but that it happens. And also the voting structures in a lot of these groups don't help. But one of the things that I said to, I was talking to someone who was trying to establish a party, and they were talking about, you know, how do you deal with this? And I was like, why don't you look at a corporate board?
Right.
I hated to be that terrible about it, but I was like, you know, I worked at an insurance company for a few years. Or for a year, really. But they knew how to deal with sexual harassment, dating dynamics, relationships. And I mean, they didn't even ban, it wasn't like it was a total ban either, but they were right. Clearer ways of how to handle this.
They're professionals. Yeah. They know how to do things. Yeah.
And I was like, we could do some of the same things. Like, it's not that hard to set
up. And that's what's so interesting. No, I think that, and it's so funny because that, like, you could literally have, like, there are definitely, like, it's like, oh, this is how, like, I remember I was part of, you know, another part of my sort of, like, you know, interesting background, like, you know, crazy times call for interesting people, is like, I've actually spent a decent amount of time, particularly, you know, my early 20s in doing specifically Vipassana mindfulness meditation stuff. Not like in a sort of like mindfulness for productivity, but, you know, like retreat settings and so on. And actually it's, you know, there's a lot of value in that. And I was part of this group that it was actually interesting because we ended up sort of deciding collectively to make it sort of just more of a sort of community and a kind of group of friends that met once a year. And it was crazy. I mean, we would do these like retreats once a year at this, like, I mean, this unbelievable estate that was given to us in Martha's Vineyard. It was quite a thing. It was quite a trip. But for purposes of this conversation, it was like in the first couple of years, there was a sense that this was kind of like, this might be some type of, you know, training program that was like a pre-selected group. It was more of like a thing, right? And all of the, you know, these dynamics of like, you know, every decision is going to be group consensus. We're going to process things for 50 million hours a day. And I have to say, like, in the context of this group of about 20, 30 people, like, you know, it was in reality, like, actually awe-inspiring how good mostly we were to each other and how few, like, actual problems emerged, right? Like, there wasn't any ever, you know, like nothing actually did happen that was really fucked up or in any way like a serious problem. But it was also just like at a certain point, it really was just a completely inefficient way of operating. And one of the things that strikes me sometimes, it's like you look at some of these dynamics on the left and it's like, okay, so on one hand, yes, like historically you've literally had like groups that start as like, you know, some type of honorable radical initiative. And then it turns into some like, you know, horrific misogynist sex cult. And now on the other hand, you know, now like you do hear, and I don't want to over exaggerate it. I do know people I'm supportive of DSA, and I know people who I think are doing incredibly honorable and important work in DSA. But, you know, you do also see and catch some of the, you know, the type of things coming out of DSA that, you know, I mean, like the joke I make, like, you know, Castro and Che would have never been able to go to the mountains, you know, somebody would have said it was like, you know, it was, you know, they were like too machismo or ableist or something, right? Like, I mean, there's some stuff that's going on where it's like, wow, that is, I mean, it's not effective, and no normal people of any background are going to want to engage in this because it just sounds like group psychosis. And what's funny is like the obvious answer to a lot of these things. I mean, I agree with you. It's like, actually look at how corporations and organizations deal with some of these things. In some cases, they've actually found some pretty smart ways of actually balancing things like sexual harassment's a real problem. And also like, people spend all day at work together, so they're going to like fuck each other and date each other.
Yeah.
And they actually figured out some decent ways of figuring of sort of navigating that. Some, you know, maybe you gotta look at best practices. Like, not everything needs to be some sort of special new thing. I'm all about mimicking and taking from, you know, whatever sector makes sense. I mean, is that, why is the far right more effective at it? Is it because they're able to subordinate this stuff for common goals more? Is it because they're learning best practices more? Like, what is it?
Well, there's a couple of things. They have clearer subjects than we do. And I mean that not in the sense that the people that they have are more problematic. They're actually usually more socially messed up and awkward.
Right.
They have clearer means of disciplining, because there's a certain spirit of anarchism in the American left. And I find this funny. People sometimes miss this about me because they think I'm a hardcore anti-anarchist, and I kind of am. But I'm also like, but ultimately my goal really is to get rid of the government in all forms. That's just going to take probably like 500 years. So,
right.
So like, but I find that that spirit in the American left has been really hard to deal with. And it leads to a tyranny of structurelessness. But also, you know, that cliche on one hand, there's just a tendency of the structures to be really ineffective and really not adaptable when they do exist. So, you know, you either have no hierarchy or you have really rigid hierarchies. And the DSA, I don't want to turn this into a show about my issues with the history of the DSA aside, if you look at its structure, it's prone for these sorts of problems.
I'm pretty sympathetic to the DSA, but I do think that there's also something that people are going to need to figure out inside it, because I think that my read is that you kind of have gay space communism people going into the DSA now, and that's, you know, whatever you think of that one way or another, that is not, you know, like DSA, obviously, as you know, is historically like an entryist sort of Democratic Party adjacent thing for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it comes out of a split
with the
SPA, which led to two separate parties, one entryist, one that's not a party at all. I mean, and you have that, plus you have a national that has a lot of media influence, but doesn't have any, and deliberately doesn't have and doesn't really want any pull on its branches, which leads to this actually inability to hold either accountable to anything. So, like, you can't hold the national accountable to any, like, popular line within the DSA because it's kind of separate from it.
Right.
Other than when they come together to vote on conventions. But you also can't hold locals accountable to the national, because as long as they pay their dues, they're in.
Right.
And that's a real good structure for a really quick growth, but it's also a structure to make doing a whole lot of anything very ineffective. So,
I mean, it might be, you know, or conversely, I mean, I guess the best case scenario with it would be that, you know, you have effective, smart local initiatives, and then the sort of it's processed into a kind of national media landscape through the central kind of leadership. I mean, that's been them. I think that's been the best cases. Like, there have been, I forget what it, the specific one, but there was some really smart tenant advocacy in DC. Mm-hmm. There's the, you know, the tire work in Pittsburgh. I recently just did one in Brooklyn on sort of basically organizing around, you know, single payer in New York State. These are effective, tangible, important things. And I think especially some of them are really smart in the level that there still is a lot of work that needs to be done with building credibility, you know, outside of the kind of echo chamber and things like tenants' rights. Like, yeah, that's a real fucking thing, you know.
And this is good. And I mean, like, you see it in the DSA. I think you see it also in the IWW even, which is, you know, for like, I don't know, for like 50 years, didn't really do that much.
Right.
And, you know, and now is not super effective. I'm not going to lie. I mean, a couple of burger franchises have made things in liberal cities is not a workers right. revolution by anybody's. But the fact that they're doing anything at all after, you know, 3 decades of basically 5,000 people not being able to achieve a whole lot is a good thing. Conversely, I'm really torn on this third party thing because I agree with you. I told someone the other day, you know, it would be easier to overthrow the government by force with like a few people with guns than it would be to change all the state laws that make it impossible to run third party candidates efficiently.
Yeah, I think that that's actually like true. Yeah.
You know, I'm just like.
By which they're both essentially impossible in certain conditions, in current conditions. But yeah.
They are. That's my point. Because I'm like, you try to like, you know, coup the U.S. government right now in a grand revolution, you're just going to get killed. But right.
Exactly.
But to me, it's more possible than changing all the state laws.
Right. No, I think that that's 100% true.
And that, I don't really think a lot of the far leftists have thought about that, but I do also think, and the goal for me is not actually party building, it's para-institution building, but one thing that eventually does have to happen is you do have to have a real Labor Party in the United States, so.
I mean, yeah.
But I don't know, here's where I'm sympathetic, I don't know how you get there right now. I don't, I do not know how you get there, because most attempts will just become little sectarian nothings or at best think tanks. That's the best case scenario.
I think there is a decent, I mean, you know, I think there's a good case to be made. Like, I live in New York City. I think that, and it depends on your district and your individual choice as a candidate, but say if DSA really powered itself up here, right? I think that, and they wanted to engage in electoral politics, which to me, it just seems like, of course you have to engage in electoral politics. Like, that's still where, short of, you know, sort of like mass citizen-led hostile takeovers of the American corporate sector, right? Like having some instruments of political power that's still a major intervention point of what is as we create something that's different. And I would say in New York, it would be great if there was an aggressive and coordinated effort to say, like, this is going to become a two-party town. And it's the fucking, you know, real estate Democratic Party, which is really what it is, and every other, you know, corporate lobby that makes this place like a, you know, a plutocrat's playground with Dwayne Reed's on every corner and all the rest of it. And that you went, and then there was a DSA party that was like, we're all about, you know, mass public housing in New York, radical police reform, you know, all that type of stuff. I think that would have a lot of value, and would be a smart way of threading that needle. I think, or for that matter, a Labor Party. I think you're right in terms of long-term goals. I think, you know, I've looked a little bit into the Progressive Party in Vermont, and one of the things that strikes me that's interesting about it is I think it's like that in some ways like the best case scenario of what is in any way viable right now, in the sense that it's an actual party. They get people elected to office. It definitely adds a bit more of like a left-wing flavor to that state. And as they've gotten, you know, some consistency in holding different offices in the legislature, or like Mayor Burlington or whatever, the left-wing complaint is a familiar one. Like, you know, these guys are just sort of like liberal Democrats. And, you know, they are, because they're governing in a context. And I think, you know, that just is what it is. I think you're probably right, because I am not as sanguine. Like, I do think functionally you got to work inside Democratic Party structures, but I do think that it's quite evident, like the fact that the Labor Party can go to Jeremy Corbyn after like you know, Blair and Brown is so, it's like, it's because this is a Labor Party. Like the nucleus of this thing is a social democratic NHS labor friendly party.
And it comes out of labor itself. Like it comes out of Union Party
itself. And it was rebranded and it was fucked with. And it, you know, and frankly, even if we're being, and it's like, even if we're being honest, like, you know, Blair's first term actually in some ways still massive infusions of cash and things like the NHS. I have a friend of mine whose dad is a Kurdish physician in the UK. And, you know, a true hater of Saddam for obvious reasons. And he was like, yeah, my dad supported the invasion. And I was like, your dad, like, mass NHS cash infusion and removing Saddam. He must be like the only guy who loves Tony Blair. And he's like, oh yeah, totally. My dad thinks Tony Blair crushed it. Like tons of NHS spending and he got rid of Saddam. But, you know, my point being is that there is that history there and we don't have that here. And that's a big problem. And I don't know how to circle that square, but I think it would be as much of a fantasy to like, oh, we'll just have third party, you know, or that sort of thing. On the flip side, to just think that the Democrats are a totally malleable thing, is also wrong because the history of the Democrats are, I mean, there's, you know, there's everything from Southern apartheid politics to now, you know, managerial, you know, upper management politics. So yeah, it's
the Democratic Party. I mean, here's how I try to understand it. America never had a Labor Party, but it had two liberal parties, and that's, you know, fine. Yeah. And the party of bourgeois development has always been the Republican Party. When bourgeois development was progressive, which in its early period I actually think it was, I know it's controversial to say that, but you're supposed to hate capital eternally or whatever, but Marx thought it was progressive.
Yeah, so. Marx thought it was actually pretty important.
Right. So yeah. It's a progressive party. When you are in a quote, I don't like the teleological terms in this entirely, but when you are in a, when the right-wing moment is not progressive for whatever reasons, and I don't think it's all ideological, the Republican Party's a backwards den of scum and villainy. But
Right.
The Democratic Party has always kind of been a weird mixture of populists and elitists in the same party. And that's not just a now thing, and that's not just about, you know, left liberals. That was true in the apartheid segregationist period, too.
Yeah.
Yep. And that coalition has always been, if I was going to be completely realistic about the ways that I thought one of these things could happen, you would have a bunch of little parties outside of the Democratic Party who weren't really parties pushing on things. And then you have a contingent within the Democratic Party that hopefully would split it.
Right.
That would be the way, I think, if you were going to look at the historical possibilities without, like, I don't know, some kind of crisis intervention in some way that could make it happen. But, you know, I don't know how to even make that happen. And it's harder now than it used to be. I mean, I know that people didn't hear your tone exactly, but it's interesting that you basically made the same critique I did of what amounts to what people call the Ackerman plan, which is the idea that the Democratic Party is just a shell. And I just don't think that's true. I don't. And
yes, I'm not fully. I mean, I am still reading this and picking this apart myself, and I find myself, it probably is one of those conversations where honestly, programmatically or functionally, I am of the belief that you treat it like a shell because that's where there is, you know, that's where there's action and you should be involved in it. And I don't believe in turning away from it. And then there's also a part of me that just, you know, adopts the opposite position of whatever somebody's saying to me. But I am convinced enough that it isn't, first of all, that yes, it isn't just the shell. And also, again, it's not this micro historical moment. It's not like this super simplified, like, oh, you know, the Clintons and the Obamas, they just won't let progressives. Like, it's a much, you know, deeper history of what the party is and what it allows for. Because I think on the flip side, like, if we were to take a positive example, I think there's no doubt that a major reason that Medicare for All has gotten momentum, and that sort of seems to me like, you know, it still will be a massive uphill battle, but that's a pretty good rallying point for a big sort of social democratic attack. And obviously, you know, Bernie's all over it and all the rest. A big part of that reason, I think, is because, you know, like someone like my grandmother, who's like an old school, like labor, great society, New Deal type Democrat and really actually holds that tradition. And, you know, she is much more sophisticated. You know, she understands, like, you know, she's totally pro-union. She's, you know, fuck corporations, whatever. Certainly wouldn't call herself a socialist. Certainly wouldn't, you know, none of that. But, you know, Truman and FDR, like, said that government should give everybody health care. Like, so that is part of that tradition, in that case, in a positive sense. So there, you're still grafting something on something that exists in a much, you know, deeper history. And then conversely, in the sense we're talking about, there is not that history. It wasn't, you know, yes, there was a time, maybe it peaked in the 60s, where like labor was a respected and kind of honored member of the sort of corporate, and I mean it in the, you know, more Scandinavian or German, like Germany, like corporatist style of the Democratic Party. And there was different stakeholders, but they were a respected stakeholder, which is better than being like a, you know, dismissed, mocked afterthought. But they were never in the driver's seat. And that is a structural problem for what that party can be.
Well, there's also another elephant in the room. And I'm pro-union, too. But this is where I'm sympathetic to, like, the far ultra-leftist in some sense. You have to deal...
Unions suck!
You do have to deal with what happened to the union historically. And they got stalled out, partly because of the Cold War. And partly because of the structure of business unions, specifically in the United States, after Taft-Hartley incentivized them selling out their younger workers and discouraging strikes and stuff that for better contracts. It wasn't for bad reasons entirely either.
Right.
And professionalizing its staff, which needed to happen, but professionalize it out of stocks. And there's all these things that we have to deal with in regards to the unions too. And that is not to say we give up on the unions. Unions suck, blah, blah, blah. They're all bad, as a lot of my former left conference do.
But I don't think that's wise.
Yeah. I think it's super dumb. Yes. but I think you actually have to look at why unions actually become unpopular. And that the recession of union popularity, which we are living through a time where they are more popular. But it's largely because people see the benefits of them, but we're never in them to see how they fell apart. And right. I don't think that's to me, that's not a critique of the union. We actually live in a time where you could make unions better. This is not to say, oh, unions. No, we could do this right now. We could do something with it.
So do you think it's partially even just, you know, in a more narrow sense? Like, I remember, it's so funny that I'm referencing this of all things, but I remember one time, like maybe in an airport or something, I read one of a book that Bill Bradley wrote in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And actually, like Obama, like one of the only sort of people in pot, like, you know, he's able to write. And, you know, for people who don't know, Bill Bradley's, you know, definitely kind of centrist, neoliberal, whatever term, you know, Democrat. And he had a chapter on unions. And one of the things that was interesting, though, that, you know, he actually, it was funny because it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a fair amount of 90s sort of boilerplate, you know, or whatever that word is. But he did talk about, you know, when the union bosses, like when their own stock portfolios and their own pensions for their, you know, unions in a narrow sense were positively affected by outsourcing in a broader macro sense because, you know, shareholder value went up and they were also shareholders. It was easy for them to get complacent and not sort of think about emerging threats in their own futures. I was like, wow, that's an interesting thing for Bill Bradley to note like that.
Yeah, but he was right.
And it's not wrong at all. It's true.
And the thing is, here's the thing about a lot of the pro-union left right now. And on the Chapo people. Like, the most they know about unions is like being in the Writers Guild.
Right.
And that's great. It provides insurance. But we don't have this history of being disfranchised with it because they undercut themselves so profoundly. I mean, and it, you know, it's the pensions. It's also kicking all the commies out in the 50s. It's because the communist organizers were actually tended to be some of their better skilled organizers too, et cetera, right. And so forth. There's a long history of that. And I think one of the weird things about this moment with the DSA is there's a lot of push for, you know, the brochialist people, and I've been called a brochialist. I get it.
I get it.
Yeah. I used to say brochialism or broberity, but
dude, I actually think that is also totally true.
There's a certain sense to where that sort of shallow workerism, though, hasn't dealt with some real historical failures that if we don't look at closely, we'll repeat.
So here's the thing that I think also shows up in these conversations. So like I'm not even in the Writers Guild. I have some sense of unionism, I would say, actually from, you know, a part of my family, which really was like, you know, legit, like literally like worked on the Long Island Railroad union, Irish union, right? Like that. So it's not totally alien to me, but in my own life, I mean, you know, one of the ironies, and I think the irony of like certainly, you know, my buddies over at Chapo and, you know, and a lot of us, and certainly any of us who've been kind of been able to sort of put it together and make it work is, you know, we're actually, I mean, sort of, you know, advocating some version, different versions of social democratic or socialist politics. And we're actually also right now functioning in a way that actually works, even though it's, you know, utterly exhausting and, you know, precarious in precisely the rule, like, you know, the outermost reaches of like, I mean, the whole sort of like, you get to make a living, you know, being a talk show host and do it through Patreon is like one of the last sort of, you know, case studies of like the Silicon Valley utopians. It's just a paradox. And I think it's an interesting paradox to explore, but I will say that being said, with the limitations and also, you know, the sort of historical grounding that I certainly know I need to ground more in labor history. And I, you know, I do have a pretty historically oriented look, but I know a lot more about what happened like in Jamaica in the '70s or, you know, so on. But I think the dual challenge of basically kind of just any type of left content writ large is that it's like, okay, my really smart friend C. Derek Varn is breaking down like this complex labor history that needs to be accounted for so we don't repeat prior mistakes. We understand where the mistakes were made. Like, this is just not debatable. It's true. But then it's like my YouTube algorithm is such that, you know, maybe some kid who's going to watch me on one of my shows is then going to find like a fucking some friggin' troglodytes video where they're just like, unions are going to make you poor. And, you know, just that whole like right wing infrastructure of doing things like, not what you're talking about, obviously, like actual critique and historical analysis of union movements, but just, you know, pure like, you know, 21st century, like, you know, I don't know, just, you know, just low grade propaganda so that unions brands are toxic. We're sort of, I think, fighting on I think there's so many different things that are happening because it's sort of like in a macro sense, we're trying to fight, say, the democratic center plus the right, plus the oligarchs, and do things like just even detoxify the idea of unions in the public consciousness. And then inside the left, there's all of these, you know, cliches and cobwebs and in some cases, actually probably really important debates that we need to have to be better, but they need to happen simultaneously. And we also need to gauge like what is the most like, you know, is it the most valuable thing to sort of acknowledge like, hey, we're all a bunch of fucking like 30 somethings, you know, talk show hosts and journalists and artists or whatever who never been in a fucking UAW shop floor and, you know, don't understand the failings of this or that specific historical moment versus the other, you know, sort of impetus, which is that, you know, some, you know, inquisitive 20-year-old who cops my show gets to have some talking points for his idiot buddies that Elon Musk is actually an asshole for suppressing union organizing at Tesla.
Yeah, and also a total hypocrite because he's basically an Ayn Rand villain.
Yeah, he's the worst. Absolutely. I've been spending a lot of time on him recently. The cult of him really annoys me.
I mean, here's what I'll tell you from my own personal experience and what's scary. So my trajectory politically is a little bit more complicated than yours, as we talked about before the show. I was kind of on the Chomsky-ite left, but I'm from this deep South where, like, we could get those books, but what could we do with them? There weren't even protests for us to, you know, right. Like, we would go out. I mean, I went to the Battle for Seattle, the quote Battle for Seattle, which traumatized me to the extent that it made me kind of distrust the left for a long time, because so much of it was silly from, you know, from my working class background. I was like, this just seems stupid and weird. I don't know what this is about, really. And the people who spoke to that at that time were actually, as I told you, kind of paleo conservatives who could really sneak in, but it became quickly what their agenda was. And so the YouTube problem isn't new. It was even the case back in the late 90s before the internet was really a thing. And there is some, you know, when the centrists can talk about horseshoe theory, the one element of it that's true is the alienated subject is going to be attracted to both things, because they see something's wrong and there's two, like, diametrically opposed narratives as to how to get there.
Right.
There's your Jordan Petersons of the world, and then there's your us's. And in a way, you're not just wrong. You're not just dealing with the wrongness of the Jordan Petersons. You're also dealing with what they seem to be right about, and trying to be nuanced about that and not just sound like a cop out. Because one of the things I told, you know, I was talking to Douglas Lane, our mutual a friend, and I said, look, Doug, one of the things you have to admit about the post about, you know, Peterson and the postmodernist, while he's wrong that that's left, in, you know, Marxism, there's a lot of Marxists who really believe that it's Marxism, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like, you can't just white it off. You have to explain why that's false, but explaining that takes way longer.
Right.
And way more unpacking than the neat sort of, like, postmodern, you know, postmodern neo-Marxists to steal your kids. You know?
Right. Well, I also think the other subtlety that, and it just, all of this just basically reinforces that our job is a lot harder. And maybe I should rebrand myself as a member of the intellectual dark web and just make millions of dollars and just, you know, bitch about college students. But I think that, like, you know, the other thing is also disaggregating, you know, where I sort of hold the line, and maybe I hate these phrases, but in conversation with, like, you and Doug, I hold more of the, you know, a little bit of like, hey, look, man, let's be real. You know, a lot of right wing politics really is white identity politics. It is motivated, you know, xenophobia, racism. I mean, these things are real. They're, you know, very real. And not that you guys would deny it at all, but I'm just saying that even, like, the distinction between somebody who's alienated and the general notion, and I've encountered people like this too. I know what you're talking about, where it's almost like, whether it's Alex Jones or Dick Gregory or Noam Chomsky, it's just anybody that is sort of indicating that things are bad, that things aren't okay, that reflects my condition. I think that's totally real. And then I also think that there are a lot of people, like dealing with a Jordan Petersen, it's not going to, you know, talking about, like, white aggrievement and stuff like that is not the only thing that's going to deal with it, but it is a big fucking part of it. And that adds another, you know, I think, dimension that we have to, like, manage. There are so many lanes to fight on, and people, you know, have very split attention spans and don't seem to be able to do, you know, what did you say, like, multivariable analysis.
Oh,
and
yeah, that, I mean, that's
all of these things are. I mean, they just are.
And that's, it's really hard. It's really, really hard to do. One of the things that I said, you know, I'm famous for being one of those few Marxists who's known as in the anti-Depol camp, supposedly, for saying, you know, it's controversial because I said intersectionality is not actually that bad of an idea.
Right.
You know, they're like, what? And I'm like, no, it's really not. I mean, like, these are separate spheres. If you're going to tell me that capitalism is the only reason we have racism, I'm going to laugh at your face, even though idea of race is concurrent to modernity. I get that.
Precisely. And that's the type of thing that a lot of people, like, I mean, I love interviewing, you know, I've had the honor of interviewing this guy, Ronnie Casrules, a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, are you familiar with Ronnie Casrules?
No, I'm not.
So he was, when Mandela was on the run in the 60s in South Africa, they called him the Black Pimpernel.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And there was also the Red Pimpernel, and that was Ronnie Kasrils. Ronnie Kasrils was a Jewish South African communist who co-founded the armed wing of the African National Congress and was a South African Communist Party operative and served. He was deputy defense minister for Mandela, and he was the intelligence minister for Thabo Mbeki. And so first, it's interesting because, like, he to me is actually a perfect example of sort of like somebody who really transcends and is like a perfect model for how to like synthesize these debates in the United States. He's a Marxist. So the rise of sort of the origins of even things like apartheid and racism were essentially, you know, sort of like the cultural narratives that accompanied things like imperialism. Because, you know, you need to tell yourself a story to make it okay to go rob other people, enslave them, and take their shit. So whether it's scientific, quote unquote, or religious, you need to tell a narrative. But then, of course, it becomes its own self-propelling thing. You know, it becomes its own sort of zone that isn't, I mean, it is precisely what you said. It's a construction of modernity. It's connected in a byproduct, arguably, of capitalism. And also, it is a thing now.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also impulses in it, and to even break it down, like, this is where Doug and I sometimes come into heads, but I'm like, you know, part of being at least methodologically materialistic, I'm not, you know, going to dictate that someone has to be a spiritual materialist or, you know, or some kind of materialist ontology in some deep way to be a leftist, but let's just methodologically say that we're going to accept that. There are also things that racism plays into that are deeper than modernity. I used to talk about like symbolic kinship functions. You have to understand that to understand both how to overcome racism,
right,
and also how that plays into something in human beings is pretty old. But I think race as a concept, you don't see it. You know, there's no word for it.
Right.
The closest word for it you have in like ancient Greek is ethnoi, right? But it's not. That's not the same thing.
Right.
And like you go back and read ancient Christian articles, you tell me what skin color some of those saints are, you can't tell. One of the things I love that leftists do that drives me up the wall but also amuses me, when they talk about like dead white men and they're talking about ancient Greece, and I'm like,
not exactly.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, like some of the pre-Socratics and Socratic philosophers were in Libya, right? Like,
right.
Like, it's not. Those were multi, by our standards, multiracial empires.
You know, that's the thing. I'll go on that tangent for a second because it's so funny to me. Like, I mean, I read Anthony Appiah sometimes, and certainly not, you know, I don't even know he has really any economic analysis from what I've read. And you know, I don't know, like, cosmopolitanism, I mean, you know, whatever. There's a lot of problems in it. But that being said, some of his most effective writing has been on sort of establishing, like, against the right, you know, there is no Western civilization, right? Like, all intellectual, like, the cross-pollination of intellectual life is just foundational.
Right.
You really cannot, you know, it isn't like, oh, we're being PC here. It's like literally like knowledge moving across borders and boundaries and this, you know, implicate exactly what you were saying, even down to like some of what we think of ancient, you know, Greeks actually being like, you know, in on the African continent. But what always struck me about it as funny was that it was like, well, that's totally true and it's really effective and it's really important. But then that also should start to, you know, like if you read the Ethiopia argument, you really accept like, no, we have this genuinely global intellectual culture, then some of that sort of like, you know, like, fuck Socrates, that's a white man. Like, well, that should deflate some of that argument too, because we've established here that, you know, and of course, the positive version of that argument is, you know, read more and expand more, you know, broadly of every tradition. I mean, that's certainly very much my impulse. I'm very, sort of globally oriented. But on the flip side, it's like, well, if Anthony Appiah has convinced you, and he certainly, from what I understand of these things, convinced me that these sort of like boundaries of intellectual life are very, very shaky and not an accurate historical reflection, then conversely, then we can, you know, sort of like, yeah, read the Greeks and don't do this like dead white guy shtick about them. Because first of all, they aren't. And secondly, you know, this is important in our development here.
Yeah, there's certain things you can't understand unless you understand. I mean, like, it's one of the things that I was arguing with someone about. He was talking about what, on Facebook, he was talking about Western this and this and this and that and the Enlightenment and this and this. I'm like, look, I get that from the instant you had a countercurrent in the Enlightenment that was, you know, claiming universal subject, but then making that universal subject European, you know, and white.
Right.
I got it. You're not wrong about that. See John Locke in writing Exceptions to Humanity and justify, you know, universal self-property, but also having, you know, slavery. You know, the South Carolina Constitution being a prime example of that, Locke's influence on that. But conversely, the heritage of the Enlightenment isn't just Europe. Yes, it happens in Europe, happens in Europe for very historical reasons, but it doesn't happen in Europe without also the Ottomans allowing Chinese goods to come into decontextualized hands. You know, like, it's a world heritage.
Right.
Let's start talking about a universal subject again and not let it being like the West versus, and I get, you know, I get this. It's not just the right. I mean, there is a construction of this during the Cold War that I even understand practically why it happened.
Right.
You know, dealing with imperialism. But it's actually reifying a kind of racist narrative itself. So,
well, you know, someone who I'm a big admirer of, and I have a lot of on my show a lot, is Bill Fletcher Jr. And we did this another illicit history series on global Marxism and Amichel Cabral and Cabral, like, had this sort of, you know, I like this notion that what imperialism does is it stops history. It robs people. Like, and so what the radical project was to return, like, Africans to history. And then Bill Fletcher actually linked it with, like, it seemed like such an elusive obvious, but such an astute, like, there was so much Black Panther talk and it was fun. And I thought there was good critiques and so on and so forth. But, you know, I got kind of burned out on the conversation at a certain point. And then he just had this one sort of basic note, which is like, hey, look, like, it is really important that for groups of people that have been, you know, historically just sort of demoralized to have and oppressed and delegitimized and so on. Like, it is important for people to understand, like, Zimbabwe, Mali, like, you know, these sophisticated cultures and contributions. That is really just sort of, there's an innate psychological and historical importance in that. And he said, and on the other hand, he's like, and so Black Panther, he's like, symbolically represented some of that, but he's like, but why wasn't it a socialist democracy? Why still a monarchy? Like, why are they stuck? It's an idealized history, but why stuck in history? Why aren't they keep moving? And if they were, you know, moving to this enlightened sort of whatever, he's like, they would be a full socialist democracy. He's like, right. that makes a lot of sense.
It's a stalled out romanticism that creeps in, but you're completely right. I mean, I don't know. I always go back to the contradictions in the Black Panther Party, not the comic book. Although, you know, there is a tie through Ta-Nehisi Coates now. And the arguments the Black Panther Party had with it itself, you know, it ultimately sort of refuted its own nationalism. You can read Newton doing speeches that were actually attacking Cleaver and Carmichael outright. For sort of like romanticism about Africa and turning the need to bring African history back into the forefront into a kind of ethnic chauvinism. And that's always a tension in any diaspora movement. I mean, I think it's something that's it's very hard to talk about these days because of the return of anti-Semitism, but it's a tension in the Jewish movement too. That there is actually real ethnocentrism and stuff beyond Zionism even.
Yeah.
In Jewish history, and like, you can talk about it among Jews and Jew adjacent people like me. I say I'm Jew adjacent because my father's Jewish, and
same deal. Yeah.
it's one of those things that you don't see spoken about, but maybe we should, because there's a tendency in the diaspora and in an oppressed community to reach out to things to find honor that can turn pretty easily into a kind of, you know, defensible counter-chauvinism.
Right.
But defensible but destructive. Like, when I say defensible, like, it's understandable, but it's not good.
Right. I mean, I think this is where, you know, in Judaism, I mean, it's quite, I mean, now it's obviously really stark because now, like, this is turned into the, you know, the sort of global political expression of that identity is now, I mean, is literally an apartheid state. And right, I don't, you right. know, kind of nitpick about that word. It's an apartheid state. And to the extent, and to the ways in which, like, maybe it technically isn't, it is also uniquely bad. So, you know, I obviously.
In some ways, it's harder to fight than the apartheid state was.
In some ways, it is. And in some ways, I think, you know, obviously, and it's also an interesting turn right now. Like, if you had an apartheid state where you had a class of leadership that maintained, you know, that wasn't like de Klerk in the end, in terms of just having a sort of a perception that their global reputation was really bad. If the United States was just like, we're going to support South Africa no matter what you do, anytime, anywhere, any place. And there was a leadership that thought like, great, the U.S. is going to back us. We have some other, you know, even other places that condemn us, we still have business relationships with. We'd still have apartheid there. Yeah, Nelson Mandela would have been released from prison. Well, and that really accurately describes that situation. So, I mean, I think, you know, in the case of, you know, in the 60s and, you know, black liberation movements, I mean, I think Bill Fletcher Jr. is very interesting to me because I think he has a real synthesis of sort of, you know, identity and universal liberation. And I also think one of the most important things, the last thing I'll say, that Adolf Reed really hits, that I actually think is almost underappreciated when, you know, because people like to get to the sort of broader critiques he has of identity politics, which I often agree with too. But I think even just the retrieval of the basic history that, like, actually, like, the guys on the March on Washington, a lot of them, certainly like an A. Philip Randolph, they were actually quite radical. You're going to give us full civil rights and we're going to enjoin what at that time was at least, a somewhat developed American social democracy from white people. And that's going to be, you know, accessible and full for everybody. Had much more radical implications than, I mean, you know, the kind of classic example and the one I have a lot of fun with like my characters and stuff is, you know, like, something like the Nation of Islam, which in terms of, you know, posture and representation and rhetoric, it's like, oh God, you know, those March on Washington guys, they're the conciliatory ones. But no, they were actually the ones who, you know, were fighting imperialism and talking about economic justice. And the Nation, you know, yeah, white people are devils. Let's like enjoy our very, very, very understandable counter chauvinist narrative. Their actual political program was, you know, Reagan, you know, start small businesses, be religious.
Yeah, I know. People completely miss that. And miss that also in the successor parties to the Black Panthers. They were denounced by the Panthers themselves.
It's so disgusting what they did. I mean, the Black Panthers had some real fucking Marxism in it. And the fact that these, like, dumb, like, you know, they don't represent that tradition at all, the people that took that name. For better or for worse, the Black Panthers were, at their best, in my read, a global-minded liberation organization with like actual Marxist politics. Not that they didn't have many flaws and mistakes, but like they weren't trying to just create like a fashion statement. They were doing something.
No, and they weren't. I mean, like, this has come up in several interviews, but you know, they were dangerous enough that they could get redneck boys wearing Confederate battle flags to become internationalist Marxist socialist,
right?
And like, and yep, and hang out with them, and you know, yep, very much not the picture you get from the new Black Panther Party or the way the Panthers are remembered in popular culture, and unfortunately even by some of their fans, which is basically the stereotype out of Forrest Gump,
right?
Know? I mean, they weren't that at all. I mean, yeah, so you know, the answer is we don't have a lot of answers to these problems, unfortunately, as we clearly come up with, but we see the problems, and ultimately, you know, my big push right now on the left is, guys, I know we have internal debates, and I know we fight, and I know we condemn each other, and look, I am one of the most critique-heavy, snarky mofos internally, But let's remember, it's internally.
Right.
Because, you know, for all the shit I talk on the DSA, and I don't even think we share goals in some ways, and in a political moment, we might actually, some chapters of the DSA would probably be my enemy. But right. For right now, that's an internal debate. I still work with them.
Of course.
And we need a spectrum of people on the left. And these kind of weird sectarian culty things, or even like the Green Party, are they're endemical to that.
Yeah. Right?
Like, you know.
They are.
And we have to really, you know, this is where I'm super sympathetic to what you're doing, even what the DSA is doing. We have to deal with that. And some of us are going to have different opinions about how we handle the Democratic Party. It's right. not a dialectic that's clear. And I'm going to even say something even more heretical. Some of us are going to have different opinions about how we handle the Republican Party.
Wow. That's interesting. What does that actually mean? Really quick. I'm honestly just curious. I'm not triggered by that. I'm literally like, what does that actually mean?
Well, we will have to work with elements of the Republican Party in some senses to get things done. There's no way around that.
I think that this is this is another example where I think there's, and I'm just assuming that you will make the smart case for it. And if I wanted to take it in a really concrete way, like, you know, Bernie Sanders teaming up with, you know, Chris Murphy, kind of standard liberal Democrat who, to his credit's been talking some sensible things in certain foreign policy areas, and with, you know, Mike Lee, who's like an arch reactionary, they got together to, you know, pull back U.S. support for the Saudi UAE slaughter in Yemen. Like, that's sort of vintage, appropriate, and correct, like, cross, like, actually, literally, like, three-party working group, right? Like, that's sort of, you know, that's actually a great representation of what that kind of politics can be. Flip side, I don't, you know, I noticed in this sort of, like, dum-dum terrain, there was this sort of, like, oh, yeah, like, we need to, you know. And again, this is also where I think we need to make actually some distinctions even between like what we do on these sort of media platforms versus like politics, because there was this sort of like, oh, we need to team up with like, you know, Mike Cernovich because he opposes war in Syria, which like, first of all, like, I don't even know honestly what most people mean by like, that's a whole other area where I hear a Syria where I basically am almost like a man without a home on that politically. And I am.
And yeah. As a person who lived in Egypt and taught Syrian kids, both Christian and Muslim, I'm even more like,
yeah, I find so much posturing around that issue just like actually disgusting. And of course I do oppose U.S. regime change, whatever. But I'm also not in any way convinced that like, the U.S. has really been itching for regime change there. Anyway, it's a whole other conversation. But the point being that, like, no, this great trans political alliance is basically like a couple of YouTube personalities and sort of like fucking medium bloggers. Like, they'll retweet each other, which yeah. all it does is just show. And this is actually where I am really serious about the identity and like anti-racism stuff as an example. Like, no, in the broad term, you know, in terms of us building who we are, it's far more important that people know that, like, I'm on their side, you know, and we're committed and trusting of each other than I retweet some fucking nonsense conspiracy about Syria from some, like, fucking, like, you know, pill dispenser who also, like, is like Blue Lives Matter. Like, fuck that.
Yeah, so to bring that into like real conspiracy territories for a second. So I get tired of all the Russia talk from liberals.
Right.
Totally. But I will say one thing. One of the things about my particular background is I knew who Alexander Dugin was in 2008.
Right.
And there was this group of radicalized communist Marxists, and I'm putting Marxists in quotation marks, and they got infiltrated by Dugin.
Yep.
And they did it over the over North Korea, and right. there were all these like literally ex out and out you know international fourth position people. That's a Nazi group, like
yep.
not even like in the loose like, oh, they're fascist adjacent. No, this it's a Nazi group.
Nazis, yeah.
They were able to infiltrate some of those people for a long time.
Yep.
Now, what's funny about that is those people would consider themselves woke, even, but that's the same sort of thing. It's the media personality fringe opposition that doesn't have any conception of politics are...
You got it, right, exactly.
I mean, like for example, even working with someone like Trump on North Korea, for example, since that came up, is not the same as retreating Michael Cernovich.
Right, you're right. That's an even better example. Like, I think that there are some stronger versions of the, like, if this is all purely symbolic and nobody even really is using the same terms, and in 6 months when there's another I think that there are some people on the left that have, like, they've actually gotten really Pollyanna-ish in their own way about what this means. And I also think, like, there are things that people hate when I say this, but they're complicated. Like, you know, yes, does radically demilitarizing from a U.S. perspective, you know, and the war, I mean, the war games, it's not like just, I mean, war games is almost too vague. Like, they're literally exercises where you play out, as you know, like a first strike on North Korea and decapitate their leadership. I mean, it's incredibly provocative. At the same time, like, the reality is that there's a security umbrella that we've provided. If we pull back, you know, China will just, you know, and I actually think that is just what's going to happen regardless. But, like, we're talking like imperial competition here. We're not talking like evolving a better world, and people should know that. Conversely, like, yes, of course I've had to come out and say, like, you know, shut the fuck up, Chuck. Like, you don't want them talking to you? Are you a fucking idiot? I mean, and if that means that some indirect way I'm in concert with Trump against, like, the specific hysteria and fear mongering and, you know, bellicosity about them talking together, then sure, I'm with Trump. I mean, and if they actually achieve something durable, I mean, I said actually in some TV debate on some, you know, one of these global stations I go on, I was like, look, I'll be the first person to come on TV. And, you know, if this is so important to you people, I will say, Michael Brooks, give Trump credit. Like, okay, I don't care. That would be a delight.
Yeah, I mean, here it's one of these weird things where Korea particularly, because I know a lot about it.
I live there, right?
Yeah, I live there. My aunt's Korean. I have two cousins who are half Korean who served specifically there. When the Yeongpyeong Island attack happened in response to war games and we almost went to war. And it's one of the few times we really did almost go to war, because I got it from military, who knew me, who were like, we might actually fight over this. And normally 90% of the time, the military brass would be like, because they can't talk to me, but middle tier people would be like, look, it's serious or it's not. And most of the freakouts in the United States were like, oh, that's just, it's not serious. That one was real. The situation with Korea, yeah, you're right. It's inner imperial competition. China has stakes there too. We forget Chosun, the country that existed before the two countries that are here now, but only North Korea claims that name now.
Right.
And again, if you speak Korean, you know this. But it was divided in three, not two. A third of the country is part of China. A third of the old country that we would have known as Korea is an autonomous zone in China.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Most people don't know that.
Yeah.
So there's way more going on there,
right?
Than people realize. And oh yeah, you know, I said to a friend of mine, yeah, the Democrats are right that the treaty thing is basically empty, which is why the war games thing had to be given up, because that treaty is meaningless. You're not wrong. You're right about that. There's nothing concrete in that. But we didn't need war games to wipe out Libya either. So, you know.
No, you don't need war. You don't need there. Well, this is the type of thing, though, that it's like, so this is precisely the area where it actually annoys me, because it makes me be like a third way person, because it's like the U.S. should just leave. Right. Because any retraction of U.S. force anywhere is a good thing, because that just is what it is. And, you know, the only thing that happens in the world is U.S. action. And then there's the, you know, and then, of course, there's this Rachel Maddow's all like, we're going to not have war games, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, well, the third option of, yeah, we're not overnight, as the current system is, you know, globally constituted, even with a much more dovish South Korean leader, as I understand it, you can't just get out there tomorrow and just bail and just say, we're done. That doesn't work. And you could say, hey, you know what? As part of soothing this situation, we're going to stop doing games where we anticipate utterly destroying North Korea. And, you know, we have an open line of communication now, and maybe we can, you know, fucking simmer things down a little bit. Why anybody would oppose that is honestly mystifying to me.
The one thing I will say about the current era, and it cuts every which way, not just centrists, not just far leftists, not just rightists, is right. Trump is so ad hoc that he exposes all of our hypocrisy to it, maybe by accident.
That's true.
I mean, because you just never... I'm not going to say I can't predict him, but he's hard. It's the first time I had trouble predicting what a leader is going to actually do. And because Obama was the kind of rational that when she figured out his mindset, it wasn't that hard to figure out what he...
I think the thing with Trump, though, is, I mean, I almost kind of see it. Like, I just think it's... Like, I have to say, I had a funny moment of majority the other day because we played this clip by Rachel Maddow, and she was kind of doing, like, you know, and it was definitely very much a, like, Russia has a border with North Korea, you know, and I was like, oh my God, like, is she actually saying that Trump offered to give up the war game because of Russia? Like, Jesus Christ, like, these people are totally lost their minds with this stuff. And again, I'm not even, of course there was some type of weird communication with Russia, and that is an area worth investigating, right? Like, I don't, again, it's another area that I think people have polarized into very unnecessarily stupid and extreme positions about one way or another. And Sam was like, well, I definitely would have framed the segment the same way, but do you really think it's totally crazy for her to speculate that? And I was like, yeah, I do. Like, what's the channel? Like, what is the... And then I have to say it was like a Marsha McLuhan moment, and it was a classic Trump elusive obvious, because the whole debate was like, you know, is there an advisor? Is there a back channel? And this was the stuff that I was dismissing, because I just don't think even in the Trump world things really work that way. And then it was like an article from The Atlantic in 2017 where it was, or 16, where like Putin was on a call with Trump and was like, you know, you should call off those war games with North Korea. And Trump's like, yeah, okay. I was like, oh, it's literally in front of our face. All I had to do was make a phone call and ask. And I do think with Trump, like, you know, there's personal, insatiable, like literally personal and familial venial interest. And then there's just the sense of, like, you know, getting wins in the press. And then I think as far as all the domestic stuff goes, it's just whatever the Republican Party, I mean, you know, just shoveling, you know, the tax giveaways, decimating the social safety net. And when you sort of have that fusion together, it just kind of, you know, to me, it just sort of makes sense. It's like, what's in the self-interest? What will get a good press, and then what's the path of least resistance?
One of the things that made this one so hard for me to predict, though, is when Bannon was removed, and they invited all the, you know, all the Bush era, the most ridiculous elements of the Bush era, Lizard started showing up.
Right, right.
I figured we were going to go back to normal policy, and I was wrong. But you're right in the sense that I keep on telling people, don't think of Trump as completely irrational. But also, don't think of him as playing fifth-dimensional chess. Think of him as playing, like, fifth-dimensional tic-tac-toe.
I think that that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. I also think as far as the, you know, this, the real scum from the Bush administration, I mean, I know a lot more about Iran than North Korea, as an example. And I mean, look, there's one theory, like, I think this gets very 12-dimensional chessy, and I don't buy it that, you know, Bolton wants to have this process so that it will fail, so that then he can be, you know, have the lanes open for an attack. Now,
I don't see that because we don't have the troops for it.
Right. It makes total sense. I am very, very disturbed about what they might have in mind for Iran. And that, I'm not saying, like, I think there will be war. I'm not even saying it would be, like, what I would put money on. But I think that it's way more likely than it can be comfortable. And well, that is just horrible and petrifying.
It's one of those things where I had a deep sigh the moment that I saw Bolton appointed. I'm like, oh, he's going to go through that Spido. But, and here's the thing, and yep. I may be underestimating Trump, and I know I have friends who tell me who are not who are not rightists. But it does seem to me that the reason why the Iran deal is such a big deal is because he made the promise simply as a base promise. It doesn't really make a lot of like even from Trump's own agenda. Like
it doesn't. It's a base promise. I do think that there's some element of.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense from Bolton's agenda.
But, it makes a lot of sense from Bolton's agenda. I think that there's. I think there's some element of literally the anger of having to recertify an Obama agreement every 3 months.
Oh yeah, me too.
Part of it.
I do think that I actually think that's a large part of it because that's why it seems like it was there in the first place. Because if you think about, you know, if you even if you have the Mad Owing, you know, view of the world where everything's a Russian conspiracy these days, that doesn't make any sense because Russia's geopolitical strategy with Iran is like don't let there be a Sunni bloc all the way to Chechnya.
Right.
You know.
Right. I mean, the last thing I'll say before about this before we, you know, I unfortunately
run soon.
I remember, you know, that sanctions package on Russia included Iran sanctions back in the beginning of the administration. And I hate him and I'm not libertarian sympathetic remotely, but I will say, Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul were the only two to vote against it. And it was both, you know, to protect, you know, try to protect the Iran deal. And I mean, the Iran deal is also another very good example, frankly, getting back to the beginning of not having a moronic reductionist attitude about all of these people just being the same. That was actually a pretty goddamn tangible difference in the sort of general well-being of the world. And I'm a bit scared about that one. Actually,
yeah, me too. I tend to think even if things, I don't think we're going to have a war over it exactly. But none of the outcomes are good.
And I'm somebody who doesn't like. I thought it was horrible, but even during the kind of fire and fury time, I was like, yeah, I don't think we're going to have a war with them. Like, I'm pessimistic about a lot, but I'm also not like. You know, people also spin a lot of scenarios for themselves. I think to kind of like make situations that are actually already terrible freak them out even more for some reason, and usually kind of buy them. But in the Iran realm, I see and I agree with you. It doesn't even need to be like the full catastrophe, but it's just like it's really not good in a way that I think is actually like, you know, tangible beyond the just sort of. Traditional grinding misery of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East in general.
So, yeah.
On that hopeful note.
Yeah, we should end off. I've enjoyed talking to you, and it's nice. It's been fun. Thanks, man.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. We'll definitely do a lot more of these. Thanks a lot, man.